I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Back in October, the heads of Homeland Security and National Intelligence said the Russian government hacked the Democratic National Committee and wanted to interfere with the U.S. election process. Last Friday, the Washington Post and the New York Times reported the CIA was confident that Russia intervened in the election to help Donald Trump win because of what they called overwhelming circumstantial evidence. Donald Trump was asked about the allegations by Chris Wallace on Fox News Sunday.
According to the Washington Post, the CIA has concluded that Russia intervened in the election to help you win the presidency. Your reaction?
I think it's ridiculous. I think it's just another excuse. I don't believe it. I don't know why. And I think it's just, they talked about all sorts of things. Every week it's another excuse. We had a massive landslide victory, as you know, in the Electoral College. I guess the final numbers are now at 306, and she's, down to a very low number. No, I don't believe that at all.
You say you don't know why. Do you think that the CIA is trying to overturn the results of the election or somehow to weaken you in office?
Well, if you look at the story and you take a look at what they said, there's great confusion. Nobody really knows. And hacking is very interesting. Once they hack, if you don't catch them in the act, you're not going to catch them. They have no idea if it's Russia or China or somebody. It could be somebody sitting in a bed someplace.
Yesterday, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell announced that two Senate committees would look into the CIA's assessment that Russia meddled in the presidential election.
The Russians are not our friends. They invaded Crimea. Senator McCain and I and some of our Democratic friends met with a delegation from the Baltic countries just this past week to say that they're nervous about the Russians, to put it mildly. Let me also say, as I said last year, NATO's important. We intend to keep the commitments that are made in the NATO agreement, which I think by any objective standard has probably been one of the most, if not the most successful military alliance in world history.
We asked Karen Demirjian to join us on Radio Time. She's a reporter for The Washington Post covering foreign policy and national security. And Karen, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you.
Have we ever seen such a public argument before between a president-elect versus the CIA and now versus members of the Republican Party?
No. I mean, the schism that you're seeing right now is pretty pronounced. There have certainly been episodes in the not-too-distant past when members of Congress have raised doubts about intelligence coming out of the intelligence community. I mean, Donald Trump actually raised this as a counter to that Washington Post report, saying, look, the CIA has been wrong before. I mean, remember weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. But this is weird because you have the incoming president casting a lot of doubt on the integrity of the intelligence, which, is coming out of the administration, the current administration. You have members of Congress now rushing to defend the intelligence community, while at the same time, the Republicans are trying to kind of deflect direct blame against Trump, even though clearly they don't agree with him. And Democrats are saying, look, this is just completely, Trump's the one that's politicizing this. And look what we've been saying this the whole time, through the election, too. So it's such a mess right now with all the finger pointing that's going on. And the fact that you have a president, incoming president, who's actually saying, I don't believe this intelligence. I think it might be biased and politically motivated and all the rest of it. That's different. That's definitely unique. And it's unique to see leaders in Congress rushing to defend the intelligence community against a president.
Is it hard to verify these kinds of reports? Yes, they were in The Washington Post and in The New York Times, I'm assuming, vetted to the degree that these kinds of reports or allegations can be vetted. But as the public, can we be confident that this is the true assessment of the CIA?
Well, as we reported in another article, sure, this is the assessment of the CIA, but it's not necessarily the assessment of every other area of the intelligence community. The CIA and the FBI are not sprouting the same line about exactly the purpose behind Russia's attacks. And there's a number of reasons for that, including, the standard to which they have to apply themselves. But in this sort of a situation, you are going on the assessments of these different intelligence agencies, and sometimes they are not always exactly lined up. That is leading to many members of Congress now, especially on the Republican side, saying, well, this is one piece of it, but this isn't the whole picture. There's other intelligence out there that says maybe they weren't trying to intervene to help Trump, but they were trying to intervene to just cast a lot of doubt on the electoral process. It seems like the consensus among Republicans and Democrats who are briefed on this stuff, though, is that certainly there was some Russian involvement. They do seem to find the intelligence that they are hearing to be credible, no matter what part of the intelligence community it's coming out of, that at least Russia had played a role. Now, and that Trump won't even go that far, as you heard in that clip that you just played.
Right.
He's saying, you know, maybe it's Russia, maybe it's China, maybe it's some guy in New Jersey. I mean, he's been saying some permutation of that since the debates. So.
What will these – there are two Senate committees, as I understand it, and perhaps there will be committees in the House as well, to look into these allegations. Do you know, Karen, what they're going to be looking at?
Well, sure. Actually, it's probably going to end up being more than two Senate committees, even though McConnell mentioned two yesterday in his comments. So the Senate Intelligence Committee is going to continue looking at just generally threats of Russian hacking. They take a very close look at cybersecurity and cyber hacking in general. They will probably look not just at Russia, but beyond that, too. Their chairman, Richard Burr, has stayed fairly mum, although he did say that they would be continuing to pursue their efforts about cyber hacking across the board. You also have the Armed Services Committee. John McCain, who's probably one of the most vocal critics of Trump in the entire Congress, leads the Armed Services Committee, and he has already committed to do a look at what Russian cyber threats are to the United States. Now, his buy-in is through the military, right, because there's many sorts of – there's allegations that have been in the past that, you know, there's been Russia's hand behind hacking that have gone into the Pentagon. But also just that's a very serious concern to be able to maintain the integrity of that cybersecurity in the military space. But as he said, it's going to bleed over into talking about what happened during the election because we can't not talk about that at the same time. Senate Foreign Relations Committee, Bob Corker is the chairman there. He's also committed to take a look at this next year. So you have a lot of different people in the Senate that are jumping onto it. It's interesting that in the House – you don't really to the same extent. I mean, you have the Armed Services Committee saying, well, we've already always looked at, you know, Russian hacking, so why wouldn't we continue? And the Intelligence Committee saying, we've got this under control. Why are we making a big fuss over it? And Paul Ryan is kind of backing them up and being like, this doesn't have to be a major new effort coordinated thing. We were always paying attention. Nothing really crazy to see here, folks. And you do see a slightly different tone coming out of the Senate where, you know, McCain is saying we got to coordinate this, we got to redouble our efforts, and McConnell seems to be saying, okay, I'm at least in the loop on this, and I'm saying that yes, this is a serious thing.
Does any of this, or could any of this, call into question the results of the 2016 presidential race?
You will certainly hear a lot of discussion on that front. I have no doubt. You already hear many people from the Democratic Party saying they were warning about this during the election, and this cast doubt on the integrity of the election. I don't think anybody yet has gone so far as to say, had the Russians not been involved, then Hillary Clinton would be our president-elect. But you may, and certainly you're going to hear discussions at that level. I think that the question is going to be coming down also to, you know, what do you consider to be the extent of hacking? Did Russia go and bug the voting machines in Detroit? Maybe not. You know, did they actually manipulate the vote totals? Maybe not. Did they have a hand in, you know, the hacks of the Democratic National Committee and Clinton's campaign director? These are the email transfers that were released through WikiLeaks that were, you know, showed, caused a public scandal, were embarrassing for the Democratic Party and the Clinton campaign as well. You know, did they have a hand in that? Well, that seems to be some consensus that, yes, that Russia did have a hand in that and that they may have played a very significant role in the dissemination of all the fake news that was out there as well. So, you know, how close did it get to the actual casting of a ballot? And does it have to have been, you know, hacking of the casting of the ballot to be construed as manipulation of the election result? You could actually measure that if that's the case, but that's probably not going to end up being the case. It's going to be these other things like the email hacks and releases and those WikiLeaks dumps, like the fake news, and how you quantify that is very hard to do. So I'm guessing you'll probably hear a lot of allegations made and very few conclusions drawn on that front, and it'll just be kind of lingering out there as part of this discussion as we go through the next several months of what these investigations will yield.
Well, to be continued. I'm sure we'll be following this, probably calling you back. Karen, thanks so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome, Karen Demirchin. She's a reporter for The Washington Post covering foreign policy and national security. Joining us now is Glenn Carl. He served 23 years in the clandestine services of the Central Intelligence Agency, the CIA, wrote a book called The Interrogator. And Glenn Carl, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
So what's your response in the last couple of days of news? First, the reports from The Washington Post and The New York Times. Then we hear President-elect Donald Trump pushing back on these allegations. Where do you stand on these issues?
Yeah, I was listened with great interest to your previous caller, the Washington Post reporter. She's yes. really quite good. But the perspective also differs. I mean, her job as a reporter is to give a comprehensive view of the various positions of the various parties. And then one of the problems with the press, and I am in no way criticizing the press, but what happens is that by objectively, fairly presenting all sides of an issue, which they must do, that leads us to a position where truth becomes hard to find. Everything becomes a he said, she said debate. And in fact, we can see the fact. To establish some hierarchy of importance and find truth rather than simply competing arguments. Well, meaning that it's been 18 months that I and many others, at least, have been very concerned about the role that Russia has been playing in the election. And I think we make an error if we look at it, set our standard of saying, well, did they hack into the ballots? Because the truth is, we know, we've always known, but here we now have overwhelming evidence to support the assessment that the Russians have meddled in the election. And the far graver way they do so is by affecting public opinion and therefore votes. And they do that by their WikiLeaks, by feeding stuff quite possibly to the Trump campaign, even if they don't, by shaping opinions of the electorate. And that is beyond a shadow of a doubt what has occurred. And that's a grave matter. Well, that's known.
Let me quote you. This is the L.A. Times. No, I guess the Guardian. You're quoted as saying there is not just smoke here. There is a blazing 10 alarm fire. The sirens are wailing. The Russians provided the lighter fluid, and Trump is standing half burnt and holding a match. We're almost up on a break there, but a quick translation for us.
Oh, well, the economic ties of the Trump campaign, hundreds of millions of dollars being fed by Putin's acolytes and people beholden to him through Trump entities, itself raises dramatic issues of compromised national interest, because here you have the president who's beholden for hundreds of millions of dollars to Putin's regime. That alone is enough. That's simply taking straightforward economic ties. The others I can talk about later if you need to take a break. Sure.
Absolutely. Well, let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking about what just about everyone is talking about this week. The fact that the CIA told both The Washington Post and The New York Times that they believe that Russia worked to deliberately influence the presidential election in favor of Donald Trump. Talking with Glenn Carls, served 23 years in the CIA, wrote a book called The Interrogator. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
We have to know the facts here, and it's not at all clear to me, just viewing this from the outside, that this hacking into the DNC and the RNC computers was not a false flag operation.
Talking with our guest, Glenn Carl. And Glenn, first of all, what's a false flag allegation? Operation, I should say.
Let me use another metaphor or analogy to dismiss whoever that was just saying. You know, that's a red herring to raise the false flag issue. I mean, a false flag is when I say present myself to a foreign target whom I want to have commit espionage for the United States. But I don't say I'm an American. I say I am French or German or Israeli or something else. So the flag that he believes he might be working with is not actually the flag or the country that he is working for. So the allegation there is that it's not the Russians. As some cockamamie politicians said, that it's the Obama administration that might have been doing this. That's all just smoke or red herring, whatever you want to say, to turn attention away from the facts that are pretty clear. This is a nonsense argument.
Let me ask you, and we learned this morning that Rex Tillerson, the head of ExxonMobil, is going to be Donald Trump's nominee for Secretary of State. We know that ExxonMobil has business ties with Russia. Rex Tillerson was given an award a couple of years ago by Vladimir Putin himself. I'm also thinking of Flynn, the national security advisor, also has some connections to Russia and Vladimir Putin. I'm thinking about Paul Manafort. I think we're all struggling with these various dots that are out there and how, if anyway, we're supposed to connect them. And if we do connect them, what that means. I'm curious about your take.
Yeah. You know, one of the standards that the CIA has to use, because proof is almost impossible to establish beyond a shadow of a doubt in intelligence work, is to look where you see smoke. And if there's a lot of smoke, then you think, you know, something is going on. And then you try to take measures to counter that. So when you start seeing consistently the only, starting with the only policy plank changed in the Republican convention concerned our positions towards Russia, so that the position was softened. When you then start to see all of the nominees being very sympathetic to Russia for positions, and consistently the only almost coherent position that Donald Trump has taken on foreign policy, aside from being an isolationist, is positions of sympathy to Moscow rather than to the historic traditional positions of the United States and our allies, then you start to see a pattern, and that adds up to smoke. So these things are of concern.
I'm looking at something that Glenn Greenwald wrote in The Intercept, and his criticism, I guess, of this response to these various articles, that it is based on unverified assertions of anonymous officials who are in turn disseminating their own claims about what the CIA purportedly believes, all based on evidence that remains completely secret. He goes on to really raise questions about the CIA. And of course, we know what Donald Trump said about the intelligence related to weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And I guess the question is, based on the CIA's track record, and you were a member of the CIA, whether we should believe everything.
Yeah, well, no one should ever believe anything. I mean, if you're an intelligence officer, at least. sadly, it's a very cynical world. You know, but it's also true that probably 98 or 99 times out of 100, the CIA gets things right. What one remembers are the one time out of 100 where we drive somebody, at least give information to someone to drive over a cliff. But most of the time, we get stuff right. Now, Donald Trump's comment on the weapons of mass destruction, I will point out, it's somewhat alarming that the FSB, that's the Russian Intelligence Services, apparent line is to point, you know, this is a switch of focus from you holding your hand in the cookie jar to saying, well, but, you know, Glenn Carl left the cookie jar on the counter, so why are you blaming me? I mean, that's the kind of argument it is to talk about the Weapons of Mass Destruction report rather than the issues that are going on. Glenn Greenwald does some good reporting, but he also has a reflexive default position of hostility to the intelligence community in general, and likes to cast doubt on things. So, you know, you always want to look at the source, and each source there I find to be more telling than their comments themselves.
Let me read a couple of emails. One from a New Jersey listener. Where was the question about this country's concern over hacking when foreign powers have been hacking government agencies for the last 4 years? The Obama administration, only when the Democrats lost it lost its branches of government. Is this an issue? Democrats lost. Get over it and move on. This is nuts. An email from Joan. I heard an analyst earlier on NPR say that what is different and new about Trump's denial compared with other presidents is that he is dismissing the findings before any analysis of the evidence. This is what he is doing that is very frightening. Are you concerned about this? And I'll add one more thing to this, Glenn, which is that Donald Trump has decided, and I don't know how unprecedented this is, that he doesn't need these daily presidential briefings about intelligence.
So there you have three things. I'll try to see if I can remember them. The first one was actually a silly comment.
Just get over it, essentially.
The intelligence community has been, and all presidents have been seized, if not frantic, certainly gravely concerned with the threat and ongoing existing of, in fact, of cyber attacks and cyber vulnerability. The government under President Bush continued by President Obama, a major initiative in the intelligence community to try to get on to do whatever was possible to do to protect America's cyber infrastructure, private entities, which means people or corporations, public services, and national security establishments, to the tune of many, many billions of dollars being spent and large amounts of energy being devoted to trying to get on top of this. So that's simply not true. There hasn't been concern. Every day, I think that there are something like 25,000, what could qualify as 25,000 attacks against the Pentagon, as well as the rest of the various federal entities. So that's simply not a true statement. And to say to get over it is, you know, that's sort of Tea Party Trump speak that says, well, you lost and this is not a concern. What is of concern is when the national integrity is threatened, our electoral process, our system of government, and the election of someone who seems to share the positions of Moscow rather than those of Washington. That is what is of concern, so one should never get over that.
Well,
the other two things?
Yeah, I mean, one having to do with I guess, the fact that he's the president-elect, apparently getting some of these presidential daily briefs, but apparently not believing when the allegations are that Russia was monkeying around with our election.
Yeah, well, here we have, some have said, well, you know, there have been tensions between the intelligence community, the CIA, and the president in the past, so what's the difference this time? Well, it's quite different. Yes, I mean, our job is to make the president uncomfortable, frankly. We are supposed to speak truth to power if we are good enough and courageous enough to do so. That's the job. And often presidents won't like that because what we say doesn't correspond to what they want to hear and what they need to hear to do what they want to do. That's natural. That's okay. That is not what is happening in this instance with Donald Trump. Donald Trump is showing has consistently shown a fundamental ignorance and incompetence and hostility to anything that shows that challenges any position or assertion that he makes, to the point where he is dismissing the work of dozens of thousands of dedicated public servants out of hand unless they all kneel down and kowtow. And that is not the same thing as simply disliking a weapons of mass destruction assessment or its lack.
And
totally, totally different.
Final question before we have to say goodbye to you. There are a couple of congressional committees who will be looking into this. What do you want them to look into?
Well, I'm sadly a little skeptical. It's a good thing that they're doing that, but I'm a little skeptical of this because I have seen the oversight committees be politicized. Republicans protect Republican presidents, and Democrats have tried to argue against that. The Senate report issue was, a travesty of the functioning of government. It was an objective report and was dismissed because it made a particular administration look bad. So I'm hopeful, but wary that much would happen. What should happen is a thorough look at what measures were taken that could have affected public opinion and our electoral process. That would be, looking at the intelligence. It's sort of like a 9/11 commission or a Benghazi commission, except actually I shouldn't throw Benghazi in because this issue is a real one as opposed to a made-up one.
Glenn Carl, thanks so much for joining us today in Radio Times.
My pleasure.
Served in the CIA, wrote a book called The Interrogator and Education. Joining us now is Clint Watts. He's a Fox Fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, which is here in Philadelphia. He's a senior fellow at George Washington University Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. He served in the U.S. Army and in the FBI, where he worked on counterterrorism, and he joins us from the NPR studios in New York. And Clint Watts, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. And I have to say, one of the reasons we wanted to have you on is that we read your story that you wrote with several others in War on the Rocks. This was a story with the headline, Trolling for Trump, How Russia is Trying to Destroy Our Democracy. This came out on November 5th, the day before the presidential, the election that we had, obviously the next day. What is the sort of warning that you were issuing out of this story?
I think our main concern was going back to the summer. We had spent more than 2 years watching how social media influence operations, predominantly out of what we believe to be the Russians, were trying to push the U.S. election in one direction or another. And at first, we just were going to monitor it, kind of use it as a case study. But once we started hearing the Trump administration discuss and use some of this propaganda that was coming out of Russia, we began to write up some of our findings. And our first one was really about a fake faked terrorist attack pushed by Russian news outlets back in July, which presumed that the Incirlik air base was going to be overrun. And we had been watching this network for some time. And the Trump campaign, specifically the campaign manager, Paul Manafort, actually used that fake story to argue on the news. And that sort of pushed us then to write up our findings, which is how Russia, they don't hack the vote. They win the vote. And they do that through a combination of overt and covert means to sow mistrust ultimately in the U.S. electorate. And it's not just about President-elect Trump or a candidate Clinton. It's really about undermining the effectiveness and the trust in democracy for those voters that are out there in America.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that because one of the things you write in this article was that from your perspective, this either the fake news stories and the other ways that Russia was intervening was really to raise questions about the results of the election, how we raise president, how we elect presidents, can we rely on the results? What the CIA seems to be saying, and I know you were in the FBI, is that Russia intervened to help Donald Trump win the presidency. Based on what you know, can you go that far?
I don't think those two are mutually exclusive. I think that Russia preferred, obviously, Trump as their chosen candidate to win the election, much like they chose and sort of promoted the leave vote and the Brexit campaign. So they would very much like to have Trump as the winner. But they were also prepared beyond Trump to erode either a Clinton presidency by undermining her mandate to govern through enormous divisions in the U.S. electorate, but also to erode trust in government institutions. And so Trump actually echoed one of their key propaganda lines, which was the election is rigged, the election has been hacked. That sort of conspiracy feeds into the American public that if they can't trust the results of an election, whether Trump or Clinton wins, then they will then move away from democracy in general. You've already seen that in certain polls where for the first time, Americans aren't sure that democracy is necessarily the best form of governance. You're seeing them move away from active participation and move possibly even towards violence. We've seen in the case of Pizzagate in Washington, D.C., where people have taken on some of these fake propaganda lines and mobilized to what might potentially be violence. And that is to essentially create and sow divisions, as their old Soviet playbook says, use the force of politics rather than the politics of force to really erode the United States from the inside out, to be indecisive in their foreign policy, for voters not to trust their public institutions and even media figures such as mainstream media reporters.
Can we say then, Clint, that Russia is looking at the United States and what we are talking about on the radio, what Congress is doing, what Donald Trump is saying, and they're saying mission accomplished?
It is an extension of the victory they achieved on Election Day. Not only were they able to divide up the electorate amongst social, political, race issues and promote that in what you would call a state-to-people strategy. This goes back to their old Cold War playbook of them using state-to-people politics. Rather than going from state-to-state to try and influence perhaps the United States, they engage in the electorate to try and shift opinion and resulting in candidates to pursue their interest. And you're seeing this unfold even doubly right now. So Trump was a great achievement for them in terms of his victory essentially brings about a lot of policies and policy advisors that are very pro-Russian as compared to any other time in U.S. history. It's sidelined Republicans, which are traditionally the more anti-Soviet historically and anti-Russian today candidates that are out there, much more than Secretary Clinton. And they have now pushed this decisive narrative of you can't trust the government, you can't trust intelligence assessments, you can't trust the vote, maybe it's been hacked. They have essentially created a world where Americans can't tell fact from fiction, and they now fall to views that they like to find comfort. Whether they ultimately end up to be true or false, we won't know.
Is this a version of the Cold War?
The Cold War started essentially with the Snowden leaks and with the invasion of Crimea. The U.S. has been extremely slow. The Obama administration has reacted very slowly to Russia, and Russia has very smartly identified its foreign policy desires and strategically moved to achieve those, whether it's Crimea, specifically breaking up the European Union and weakening NATO, the Syrian conflict, and making sure that they keep their hand in it through the Assad regime. They have moved decisively on every one of these issues, and the U.S. government has been very slow to react, either disengaged in terms of foreign policy, wanting to remove itself from the Middle East, which has given Russia incredible opportunity, or focusing heavily on the domestic scene to the neglect of the international scene.
About a minute before a break here, but is this through a campaign of disinformation or even fake news, or is it going so far as to hacking voting machines, or do we know the answer to that?
We don't know the answer, but we are in our media here in the States trying to say it's one or the other when it's actually both. Hacking voting machines, whether they did or not, sows distrust in the election system. Hacking public figures and strategically releasing information nukes on the Podesta emails, the DNC, Colin Powell, that all erodes confidence in public figures, that the system is rigged against the voters. It's not true representation. And so hacks and influence, the Russians don't see them as two separate spheres. They see them as one and the same. Hacks power the narratives, which inform influence. Engagement on a one-to-one basis opens up people to be hacked. So it's a symbiotic relationship between the two.
And again, that's Clint Watts, our third of three guests in this hour of Radio Times. He's a Fox Fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, also a senior fellow at George Washington University Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. He served in the U.S. Army and in the FBI, where he worked on counterterrorism, and also writes for War on the Rocks. And it was a story that he and several others wrote that caught our eye. An issue very much in the news in the last couple of days. 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Clint Watts. And just to recap here, the Washington Post and New York Times have reported that the CIA believes that Russia worked deliberately to interfere with the presidential election in favor of Donald Trump. Trump has dismissed the claims, revealing a growing and very public tension and mistrust between the president-elect and intelligence agencies. A bipartisan group of lawmakers will be investigating how the Russians were able to meddle in the 2016 election. Let me get Sarah, who called us up from Philadelphia, to join our conversation. And Sarah, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Okay. Hello.
Hi there. Go ahead.
Hello.
Sarah.
I'm a judge of elections in Center City, and I was trying to explain to people it has been very difficult, if not impossible, for anyone to hack into the machines in Philadelphia. But we had at least 10 people show up at our polling place who had gone on their cell phone to find their polling place, and they were sent to us, which was not the correct polling place. We ended up doing 22 provisional ballots because I was not going to send people off to wait in another line somewhere.
All right. Well,
somebody was hacking into some website where people were looking up their polling place, and they were being sent to the wrong one.
Well, Sarah, I appreciate your call. And Clint, I think this raises a question, first of all, and we actually did a short interview right around the election time about the polls, or I should say the voting machines in Philadelphia. They're not online as people do vote, raising questions, putting to sleep some questions about whether they were hacked or not. But what you hear from Sarah is something that looked a little untoward and then raising questions about whether this was hacking or not.
That's right. And if you're Russia and you want to affect the vote or sow mistrust, it's much more easy to influence people or to do a very simple change in terms of the integrity of information than it is to actually hack into the votes and try and change them. We have to remember the calculus, even on the Russian side, is hacking into a voting machine and changing the result or getting caught for that could be deemed an act of war, whether it's a Democrat or a Republican serving in office, whereas simply influencing people to not trust the system or to do things like hacking voter rolls. That was one of the accusations that's been levied, that in Illinois and Arizona, voter databases had been hacked into or accessed or possibly changed. that sows doubt, which then makes it more believable to the American voter that their vote was either changed, miscounted, or somehow destroyed. Mm. And that's where the dangers come in. It's not from the actual act of hacking. It's from the belief that it could happen. And up until this election, I don't think anyone ever thought that was possible.
And can we say it's the Russian government? We've heard about these trolls, these troll farms where they're sending out lots of in many ways, false and fake information. Who and what is behind all of this?
Right. I think for our analysis that Andrew Eisbert, Jay Amberger, and I did, you know, we focus on what the Russian media outlets put out first. If you look at RT and Sputnik News, they put out a mix of information. If I had to estimate it, probably 70% of it is true, selected true information that supports one of their lines. Another 20%, though, would be manipulated truth, where they take bits and pieces of information and cast it in a story that comes up with a false assertion. And then 10%, which is the Intler case study we talked about at the Daily Beast,
right,
is deliberately false information that they use. To be a good propaganda outlet, you still have to have a preponderance of true information out there, because otherwise you ultimately will lose your base. You will lose your base of readers and support. But what they do so effectively is from that overt information, they then amplify it through the use of automated bots and overt news aggregators that are very pro-Russian. One of the sort of false narratives that's being pushed in the U.S. media right now is that this is all covert. It's actually not covert at all. Most of this influence activity is very overt.
Hmm.
The Russians are very forward about what they want in terms of their national interest, the candidates they want to support, and the stories they want to support. But in the case of false news that they push, they use automated bots, which amplify the false story to such an extent that even when it's proven false, the true information can't reach the surface. It's essentially a sea of information around that story, most of it pushing their line instead of actual good reporting.
In fact, you said there were a number of stories that allegedly came from whitehouse.gov.
Right. When we initially started on this, what triggered our eye back in 2014 was a petition for Alaska to go back to Russia. And when we watched that, it was another one of those sort of shocking things to look at. Were there really these tens of thousands of people that wanted Russia to go back? Or Alaska to go back to Russia. And when we analyzed that activity, it looked to be a bot. It has certain mathematical computations about it in terms of follower and following relationships and in terms of social media accounts. And that's really where we got started monitoring these social media networks online.
In fact, there was another story about removing George Soros' own voting machines. Of course, he doesn't own any voting machines, but that was also something that seemed to originate from whitehouse.gov.
Right. And that is a very classic way to sow fake news or to cement it in people's mind that it could possibly be true. You put it on an official platform like the White House website, and people will look at it and say, well, there must be some credence to it or we wouldn't even be evaluating it. That is a classic approach. And you do that through what we call, you know, in our diagram in our article at War on the Rocks, we call white, gray, and black. So you use a mix of overt outlets, outlets that seem to be very pro-Russian but appear to have no direct connection. And then you actually use social media personas that are covert or what we call black accounts that do one-to-one hacking or one-to-one influence of certain communities.
What is the United States doing to counter these attacks? I mean, I guess in many ways we have to think of them as attacks.
The U.S. is flat-footed on this.
Really?
We've not done well. If you even just rewind over the last year and a half, we have had trouble even dealing with the counter-ISIS campaign. We haven't been able to counter the Islamic State as they've run wild with social media propaganda and online recruitment. And this is a much more sophisticated actor. Russia and China, many other nation states are doing this as well. And they are not necessarily recruiting people to violence, at least yet. But we have no consolidated entity or effort that's out there to actually go at dealing with Russian propaganda. During the Cold War, we had.
Why is that?
Well, during the Cold War, we had what was known as the U.S. Information Agency, and that was predominantly their responsibility was to assess how foreign governments were trying to oppose the U.S. or counter the U.S., and then to meet those propaganda lines and try to counter them. Today, there is no longer a U.S. Information Agency, and so this very much falls through the cracks. State Department, the Department of Defense, the U.S. intelligence community all have a role in this, but they have not been coordinated or organized very well against nation states in recent years. We've been predominantly focused and obsessed over the last 15 years with countering terrorist groups and their propaganda.
You also document the use of what's called honeypots, and I guess these were back in the olden days of the Cold War, where a woman might try to seduce someone to try to get more information. I'm being very gender-oriented by putting it that way. But you're saying even today on the Internet, there's a kind of a honeypot used to seduce a target.
That's right. And you know, we like the classic characterization of this as a woman, but it can be a man as well. But the idea is that you use social engineering to appeal to the desires of a person that you want to influence or hack into, and you cozy up to them. And the one thing that we should note from all of this hacking activity is TV kind of gives us the perception that hacking is very complex and super sophisticated. But what the Russian hackers have done is actually very basic. It's very common of all hacking. They have used social engineering, you know, either through honeypots or through traditional spear phishing. They've sent links to key targets, public figures, government officials, and then they've conducted what's known as a watering hole attack, where you log into a website potentially that looks like an email login page and you cough up your credentials when it in fact is not an email login page. And they gain access to that information by building trust initially in those social media spaces and then taking advantage of that trust to access your accounts. And this is a classic hacking technique that's very basic and not super sophisticated. They just employ a lot of hackers and a lot of mass, and they stay at it over an enduring time. They're a persistent threat that doesn't go away.
Let me get a couple of callers in. We got some comments as well. This is John from Princeton joining us on Radio Times. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
There was an article 2 days ago in the New York Times that downplayed the severity of this incident, but this is the same article that also stated that the hacking came from the GRU, which is their, as I understand, that's their military intelligence division. And it's not even like the NSA here, because they have their special forces with them. And my concern and question is that, do you think there's this kind of downplaying when we call it merely hacking? Because it should be, to me, it sounds like it should be considered sort of a military operation on the part of Russia coming, you know, if it is indeed coming from their military intelligence groups.
John, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Clint, you want to respond to that?
We are entering a new era where the U.S. has to decide how they want to deal with a nation state that is not putting their physical imprint on our country, but are instead conducting activity at a distance that is highly effective, you know, in engaging the public. He's right. Yeah, some of these hacking groups are associated with the Russian intelligence services. Some of them are associated with the Russian military intelligence services. And so we're looking at an asymmetric hybrid fight where they're attacking on all angles. The Russians will, you know, go out to each of these intel entities and say, hack as many accounts as you can. It's essentially competing hacking between these groups. It's not even coordinated because they're not concerned ultimately about who achieves the victory as long as someone does. Mm-hmm. What we need to look at here in the U.S. is what is considered military activity versus intelligence activity of a foreign government. And I'll give you a scenario that is quite concerning.
Sure, go ahead.
During the terrorism days, there was a period where there was the Yemeni American cleric Anwar Awlaki, who was communicating via the internet, radicalizing people towards violence, and then, you know, doing direct connect with them to do attacks inside the United States. And the FBI did an amazing job over time of picking these plots off, you know, and bringing people to justice. But what if now we have a nation state such as Russia, who is reaching out to Americans using their intelligence or military intelligence service, asking them to do propaganda and influence on their behalf? What would traditionally be Soviet agent in the U.S. Doing a recruitment, but now they're not physically in the U.S. and they're doing it. What if they're asking them to do propaganda on behalf of Russia? Or even worse, what if they mobilize them towards violence? What if Pizzagate, in this case, there seems to be no evidence that it's a nation state, but what if something very similar to that happens and that influence comes from a foreign government. I'm not sure the U.S. government has figured out how they want to handle that, whether it be Russia, China, or another nation state that's against us.
Let me read an email from Maria. I'm curious about why the Russian government would want to sow these seeds of confusion in regard to the idea of democracy. What is in it for them? Clint?
It's very simple. Their campaign isn't a revolution. It's what would be called devolution, which is they were going to break up all strong unions that oppose them so that they can pursue their own needs. Their number one and two objectives, in my opinion, are the dismantling of the European Union and NATO. If they can do that, then they can increase their influence on a one-to-one basis with each of the former Eastern Bloc countries. They can secure many financial deals through oil and gas, which is their strength economically. They can buffer against what they believe as U.S. interference in the Middle East and Europe. And they can essentially run roughshod over America and expand their influence around the world, bringing back Russia to the status that it once had as a superpower. And for that, I think there are many incentives over the long run.
Well, let me pick up on a couple. We know now that Rex Tillerson, again, the head of ExxonMobil, Trump's nominee for Secretary of State, business ties to Russia involving oil and gas. Clint, what do you make of this nomination?
It is perplexing, but not surprising. I think it's consistent with what President-elect Trump has said about his stance on Russia, which is his stance has been he can make deals with Russia. We don't need to fight them. We can make deals with them. If you look at what more traditional Russian or Soviet analysts would tell you is deals with Russia tend to go sideways and you usually end up on the bad end of the stick with them. Yeah. This is a kleptocracy. This is a regime that's built on manipulating information, money, power in a way that benefits them. And so President-elect Trump has essentially put someone in at Secretary of State that is a deal maker. He's been a deal maker throughout Europe, Asia, and the Middle East. And so the question is that the best deal for America or is that the best deal for an administration that wants to retain power and influence?
And we know that Tillerson has said that he wants to lift sanctions on Russia. This obviously said as the head of ExxonMobil. Almost at a time here, Clint. So how do you think Russia then views Donald Trump?
I think they're ecstatic. They have a U.S. president that is not antagonistic, that has mentioned at times that Crimea is already a part of Russia, who has said that he would consider teaming with Russia to fight ISIS, even though ISIS is nearly extinct in Iraq and Syria. He has also said many times that he would appoint people, and he has, that are very pro-Russian in their views and would essentially hold up or want to batter NATO allies about their payments as part of that military alliance, something that Putin would love to see dissolve. So I don't know of one policy position that the Trump administration currently supports that would be anti-Russian. They all seem to be pro.
Well, I wish we could go on, but we do have to end on that note. Clint Watts, thanks so much for joining us at Dan Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. He's Fox Fellow at the Foreign Policy Research Institute, Senior Fellow at George Washington University Center for Cyber and Homeland Security. And you can check out his story, War on the Rocks, Trolling for Trump, How Russia is Trying to Destroy Our Democracy. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. And you can find out much more about this program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thanks for joining us.